Welcome once again to the Spouter Inn. I'm Chris.
And I'm Suzanne. And we're very excited to have a special guest with us today, Sandow Burke. Frequently developed as expansive multimedia projects, Sandow's works have dealt with contemporary life in its entirety, exploring themes such as inner city violence, graffiti, political issues, travel, war, and prisons, as well as surfing and skateboarding. Some of his work has specifically engaged in the kinds of great books that we explore here at the Spouter Inn, including an illustrated version of Dante's Divine Comedy, reworked with Marcus Sanders from 2005, as well as the American Quran, published in 2016. Thank you for joining us, Sandow.
Sure, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, I've been really excited about having you to join us, partly because of being so interested in your work on Dante, and I think that's going to be the foundation of our conversations today. But your work broadly engages in what happens when we encounter a text or a pictorial tradition and respond to it. And that's one of the reasons why I love your American Quran as well so much. I hope we have time to talk about that later.
Sure, I would love to talk about that.
So let's start with Dante, and I guess sort of the obvious question is, you know, how did you fall into that project? Was it something that someone else pitched to you? Had you sort of grown up reading Dante and it'd been living with you, or was it something that was new to you when you started making the work, or what was your relationship with the text?
I was not familiar with Dante when I began that project. I generally have had this career where I get like a little tiny idea that just keeps growing and growing until it gets out of control. And in this case, I was in a used bookstore here in LA, and I found an old copy of The Divine Comedy with the Gustave Doré illustrations in it. And I bought it, I think, for like $10 because I just loved the images. And I took it home where I work, and I had it like laying around on the coffee table for a year, and I would just flip through it and flip through it and start reading little bits of it. But the original idea I had was to use the Doré images of the depictions of hell and reimagine them to be about contemporary life in America. And it just sort of grew out of that.
And originally you started with a focus on the Inferno. Did you know from the beginning that you would do the three different parts, or were you starting with the Inferno and then it kind of led you on?
It led on. The original idea actually was I've been working with the same galleries in different cities for like more than 20 years. And so I was scheduled to have my next exhibition was to be at my gallery in Los Angeles, Capuan del Rio. And I went to them and I said, I have this idea of doing a series of paintings based on the Inferno, but all set in Los Angeles. And then they said, that's a great idea. And then like simultaneously, my gallery in San Francisco called and said that there was a print shop in San Francisco that wanted to do a project with me. Did I have any ideas? And I said, well, how about this Inferno thing? And then I met with them and they said, oh, this is great. We could do all these prints that look like, you know, Doré's style, and we could put them in a box and it'd be a box set. And then we all sat for a while and said, you know, it's really doesn't make any sense to have all these pictures without the text. And then that led to Marcus Sanders, who's a friend of mine from surfing. We surf a lot together. He lives in San Francisco. And he was coming through LA that night after I had this meeting. And I mentioned it to him. And he says, oh, yeah, I studied Dante in school. And, you know, we could do that together. And it sort of grew from that. And the next thing you know, we were working on a book.
And it was totally collaborative, right? The way you two work together, like you pass things back and forth. Is that right?
That's right. Neither of us speak Italian. So we got as many English translations as we could. I had probably six and he had six or so. And we would like read a canto and then sort of redo it in our own voice. And then we did alternating cantos, and then we would email them back and forth to each other and just edit them crazily back and forth so many times that it sort of became one voice.
Did you find yourselves pushing each other to sort of make it more modern, or pushing it into specific directions? Did you, you know, were you able to sort of encourage each other to loosen up with, I don't want to quite say fidelity to the text, but with what you could do with the text?
We had specific goals from the beginning. You know, since I had never studied Dante, I wasn't really even aware of this whole world of Dantistas and this giant world. So I think looking back, I think that was a good thing because I didn't feel any of the pressure to to meet up to something, and I didn't feel the real reverence towards Dante that is instilled in people when they learn more about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that would have been incapacitating, right?
And to me, teaching myself about Dante, the thing that I found most infuriating was reading along and trying to, you know, grasp the beauty of the language and the flow of it and everything, and then constantly having to stop and then go down to the footnotes and learn who the Ghibellines were and figure out all these things that he's talking about, and then go back to find out where you were in the text and keep reading. So it was really annoying. And so from the get-go, a simple thing we wanted to do was remain faithful to the text, have the same number of lines, and try to include the information necessary from the footnotes so that you wouldn't have to stop. So it was sort of an idea of creating like a first book of Dante if you've never read it, so that you could just read it right through in one go and then hopefully fall in love with Dante and go on to some more scholarly thing after us.
Yeah, you're singing from our sheet here. We're that's very much the way in which we kind of approach the reading we do together here. And the way the images were working in your rendition of Dante, like, they're not just illustrating, right? They're kind of responding in a certain kind of way. I was reading this little essay that you had written for a collection edited by Matthew Collins called Reading Dante with Images. And I was so struck by this neat thing you say there. You say, from the beginning, my images were never meant as illustrations, pictures that depict or clarify what you're reading. Rather, I see my images as contradictions to the text of Dante's poem. My images show you that the poem is untrue. They deny the poem in a sense. And that back and forth, I'd love to hear you talk about that more, because that seems so provocative and so, I don't know, challenging to the reader in a good way.
Yeah, that was my intention. Just on a real simple level, because I'm not a religious person and I don't believe that there's a hell or a heaven at all. So if you look at the images in mine, you see that, you know, Dante is wandering around like the bad parts of some American city, and he's never really left our contemporary world at any point. And so the whole conversation that he's sort of having as you read the text is, you see it sort of going on in his head, or his arguments that he's having with like street corner philosophers or homeless people or people that he meets along the way. So that was a real part of it. And then as we went through and did book two and book three, we got bolder and more assertive. And I think the drawings get better and stake out more of our personal views.
Yeah, totally. I was really struck in looking at the images, the way in which, as you were saying, the illustrations for the Inferno are really responding to Doré's work. You can really see that dialogue. But then as you get into the Purgatorio and the Paradiso, there's totally other kinds of things going on.
Yeah, that's true, because I think I got more confident and bolder, but also because Doré himself did fewer and fewer images for those canticles. So there was more holes to fill in.
Yeah, we were discussing in our episode about the sort of weird lack of imagery in the Paradiso in particular. And there are moments, and there are some very precise images, you know, the rose, mm-hmm. of course, and things like that. But everything is indescribable, and it's just God's radiance, and there's not a lot to hang on to. And yet, you know, you were able to find all sorts of things that Doré didn't really have at his disposal, because he was doing a more literal depiction of it, of the text.
Yeah. And in your podcast earlier, you mentioned the image of Mecca, that when they finally get to the center of heaven. But there's also, we were able to include funny things. For example, in the circle of Mercury in Paradiso, our scene is Dante's meeting Freddie Mercury in front of a Mercury car dealership.
I love that.
Yes. So I'm not against puns.
When it's literal, it's very literal. Yeah, well, you know, that whole way of like bringing the real world into the ineffable universe of the Paradiso, there's this one place you see this very beautifully, or at least I felt this very strongly, where you have this kind of one image that's almost a kind of a schematic map of the heavens of paradise. And it shows at lower left the sort of urban environment. And you could see labeled the layers of Paradiso: the moon, the inconstant; Mercury, the ambitious; Venus, the loving; Mars, the warriors; the sun, the wise. And then where you've got the sun, it looks like a horizon line. And then we start seeing these increasingly ineffable labeled heavens, Jupiter, the Just, Saturn, the Contemplative, the Heaven of the Fixed Stars, the Empyrean, and the Prima Mobile. But like the real world is kind of there, kind of bursting into those first layers of the Paradiso. And I just thought that was such a neat way of bringing the real world, and particularly the urban environment, the built environment, into paradise. And that's like so anti-Doré or so different from Doré. I thought it was really cool.
Thank you. Yes, it was intentional. Yeah. And then in my project, like I mentioned, I generally work with these three galleries. I had a gallery in Los Angeles and a gallery in San Francisco and a gallery in New York. And my general way of working was that I'd have like a big exhibition once a year, and like it would just rotate through the three cities. So like every 3 years it would be back. And so, like I mentioned, I went to my gallery in LA and said, I want to do this Inferno project. And then by pre-scheduled, my next show was meant to be in San Francisco. And that was just great. I pitched them on Purgatory, and it was so fortuitous because San Francisco has so many hills and so many steep streets and things. So it was like going up the mountain. And then the third show was at a gallery in New York. So it made sense to situate a lot of it in New York.
And you know, both of us basically grew up in New York. And
yeah, so the idea like, yeah,
of telling
definitely.
A bunch of New Yorkers that paradise is New York. Like, yeah, yeah, no, we're totally on board with that.
But if you look at the images, you know, the scenes of Inferno and the scenes of Paradise are identical. He's just sort of wandering around the dirty streets and of urban American cities, and you see that he's still on the same reality level of life as we are.
Yeah, it's not until you get to those final, like very explicitly religious images of the Kaaba and some other borrowed religious imagery.
Yeah, there's a beautiful one where there's, I don't know which deity is, but it's a Hindu deity in a sort of beautiful mandorla kind of form. And people are looking, and you could see they can just barely manage to take in the sight, you know what I mean? Where it's almost too bright to look. You could see they're kind of, you know, one's got his hand up to his forehead and the other one's kind of shielding her eyes a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I was so interested by that, like, 'cause I was seeing those moments, not just as kind of other religious traditions that are being intersected with Dante, specifically Christian vision of, you know, transcendent heaven, but in terms of like what people do, like in the here and now, like these two people looking at the Hindu deity are wearing like regular clothes, like the guy's wearing a hooded sweatshirt and the woman's wearing a dress, right? Like a regular kind of above the knee dress. And the image of the Kaaba, I mean, people go every year for the annual pilgrimage, you know, in other words, it's not an idealized, abstracted vision of divine experience, but rather to some extent, like what people do. Again, I was thinking about this neat thing you say in that essay I was mentioning earlier, where you were talking about depicting Dante's beloved Beatrice and like how are you going to depict the most beautiful woman in the world? Like, you know, no sweat, right? But you say this neat thing. Finally, I stuck with my own concept of establishing the work in the now. What is it like in our lives to re-encounter our high school sweetheart from decades before? Right. Like, so always asking the question, like, what does this look like now? And I feel like your work on the Divine Comedy, and this is true for the American Quran too, is always about that. Like, what is that? What would it mean for that to happen now? Mm-hmm. And I find that really, really interesting to think with.
Yeah. Because that's what happened to Dante. He saw this girl and then he didn't see her for 20 years and meets her again in heaven. And it's like a class reunion, sort of.
Yeah. No, that's right.
I'm curious now. It's, you know, it's been, what, 15 almost going on 20 years since this work finished. Mm-hmm. What is your relationship with Dante these days? I mean, did parts of his writing or the experience of working with it stick with you in any interesting ways?
Oh, sure. You know, I talked about how this project began, and it was sort of a bumbling set of accidents that led it to becoming a book. But, you know, I didn't mean that we were bumbling all through it. When we worked on the Inferno, we ended up working with a professor at Marymount University in California, Brother Michael Meister, and he was really helpful and sort of as a mentor. And then after Inferno, we met Peter Hawkins, who's a great Dantista here in the United States, and he was with us through the journey of the next two books and beyond that. And I've got to be friends with him, and I've been to all the Dante conferences, and I've learned all about Dante. And at some point I felt like I learned too much about Dante after 6 or 7 years
yes,
and moved on. But yeah. And you know, we made a movie as well.
Yeah. I've only been able to see clips of it, but it looks amazing.
Yeah, you can see it online. It's really good.
And that's of just the Inferno, right?
Just the Inferno. Yeah, it was all a movie. It took us about 2 years to make.
Wow.
And it's all the Inferno, and it's all done with paper puppets, and it's really funny, and it's much more political than the books. It's all about this when George Bush was president, so it's all about Bush and the war in Iraq going on and sex and everything. So it's really funny.
Yeah, and it seems like because it's based largely on the illustrations for the book, right, that it's able to push the Inferno even further into contemporary society, that in a sense, you know, you're much more able to play with it now that the text has been totally absorbed into the imagery.
Yeah, it was. It was really fun to make a movie. I think if you grew up in Los Angeles, it's mandatory you have to make one movie in your life.
You know, as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that really strikes me about your work is the way it's responsive, and it's kind of inviting the viewer to participate in that response and make the response their own. And I was reflecting on this, thinking a little bit about some of the ways in which you talked about your early work that was responding to monumental French historical paintings. You know, this whole question of what if we made history paintings now? What would that look like? And then similarly, we were just saying just now with regard to the Divine Comedy, you're kind of asking the question, what would it be like to run into, you know, your beloved from decades ago right now? And in your American Koran project, I mean, that, you know, what if it were now? What if it were here? It strikes me as being like one of the big guiding forces of it. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit more, this question of bringing whether it's a text or something else into this moment. Is that something that you kind of consciously developed, or does it just keep happening in your work?
Oh, it's super consciously developed. You know, I've mentioned Los Angeles again, but, you know, I grew up here and I live in the city, and it's the city where everyone works in movies and music industry and things, and it's inescapable. And I've always struggled since I ever went to art school, like, what, with the question of what is the career of making paintings in the 21st century, of sitting alone in a room and painting in a way people did 500 years ago in the world of technology and movies and stuff. So I've always wanted to make works that are about now, but then show that they're coming out of the history of art and they're tied to art history, but they're about things now, and to say, look, see how the history of art keeps moving forward and it's still connected, and the things we're doing now can be shown in that way or something. It's sort of a way to try to prove painting matters, I guess.
Yeah, I think more than that, too. I mean, at least for me, I look at it and I'm like, it makes me think about how one moment in time and another moment in time are connected, you know, whether it's a question of repetition or a kind of a symmetry or something. I, you know, when I was looking at some of your work from that earlier period, I was thinking about Kent Monkman's work. I don't know if you're familiar with it. He's a Cree artist that works up in Canada. And he's also like, whether it's Géricault or other sort of classical French painters, he'll kind of ask that question. Again, what if we made this history painting, but in another way? And for him, it's all about recounting the history of settler contact with indigenous peoples, you know, telling that story in another kind of way. But the visual language, I kept having some of those images in my mind as I was looking at some of your early work there. And I found that so provocative.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to do.
And so with the Dante and then with the American Koran project, the textual aspect of it just adds a whole other layer. Like we were talking earlier about how you, together with your collaborator, worked on your the Dante translation. So it was text, but text was there, but also the images. And then with the American Koran, you worked in, I guess not, you didn't work collaboratively, right? But in a similar way, working from multiple different available translations and making the text your own. Was that a similar experience to what you had been through with the Dante, or was it very different in terms of text?
It was very similar. But just to back up, in my career, I sort of do these projects that are big, and then they sort of just naturally lead to the next one. So when I finished the Dante project was when the war in Iraq was going on, which I was really upset about. And I ended up doing a multi-year project of this series of giant prints all about the war in Iraq. So for 2 years, I was, you know, really paying attention to the war and gathering all these images and listening to it constantly on the radio. And so much of the discourse was Americans were talking about, you know, is Islam like an evil religion? Is it fundamentally at odds with the West? Is it a clash of cultures? Is it a violent religion? And I was just so annoyed at hearing all this stuff, because I think at one point I sat down and I counted all the times I've been to Islamic parts of the world just on my tourism surfing travels. And I'd been like 10 times to different Islamic countries. And I was like, you know, no, none of the way that Americans are talking about Islam, it has anything like the experiences I had in those countries, which were fantastic. And at one point I just said, and I'm sick of listening to people on NPR tell me what Islam is. And I went and bought the Quran and I just started reading it for myself, much the same way as I came across Dante. And, you know, the first thing that strikes you when you start reading the Quran is it just seems completely familiar. You know, it's the story of Adam and Eve and Noah's Ark and Abraham and Isaac and Jesus and Mary. It's just the same thing. And it's just that it's accessible and it's easy. And you just think, you know, this isn't how it's being portrayed. And from there, it set me off on this idea of wanting to get Americans to at least crack open the Quran and read a little bit of it. And that became this giant project to make this illuminated manuscript of the entire Quran.
Yeah, it's an amazing, you know, the images, you know, our listeners might look at some of the images online, but if I will encourage you all, if you get the opportunity to come into contact with the book, it's massive. It like produces the images on this full like manuscript, illustrated manuscript page scale, and it's heavy, and it's just, I don't know, it's a weighty project in every way, and it's really cool.
That response of you know, I want people to read at least a little bit of the Quran, therefore I'm going to do an entire illustrated manuscript of it. I, on the one hand, I totally get that, but that also feels like a kind of 0 to 60 response. And I know that it sort of came out in smaller chunks, but I imagine early on you were fairly committed to doing the whole thing. I guess I'm curious about the scale of that project and how you reckoned with it, or how you accepted that, yes, you were going to do this.
It was the biggest project I've ever done, and I thought it was worthwhile. To put it simply, I thought it was worth learning about, and I thought it was worthwhile in the end, and I thought it was important thing for history. I mean, it's the first fully illustrated version of the Quran in the history of the world, so I thought that was pretty cool.
And also, like, I'm struck by something you said a little bit earlier when you were saying how, you know, when you heard in the wake of 9/11 people saying these really derogatory things about Islam and about Muslims, right? You were like, well, this does not square with my experience of that part of the world. And one way of responding to that would have been to have, I don't know, portrayed or somehow represented those places that you had experience of. But you kind of did something both much more bold and, I think, in some ways, much more powerful, which is to say, no, far from being this sort of alien, weird, horrible thing, you know, Islam is something that we can understand in terms of American experience. And, you know, it wasn't just about, you know, understanding a different part of the world. It's about understanding a culture as belonging here and now. And I just found that to be like such a really cool move, and one that you handled very carefully. And thinking back to that period of time, you know, I guess the book came out in late 2015, early 2016. You know, there's these wonderful essays that accompany the hardcover version of the book, and you know, provide responses from Muslim readers, people who've been reflecting about what it is to be an American Muslim or to practice Islam in America, and you know, kind of negotiating that complicated space. I found that to be like careful, and careful is like such an inadequate word for it, but I really appreciated that carefulness, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah. I think maybe you mean also subtle or something.
Yeah. Or exercising care, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, you know, careful in that sense. Speaking as like, you know, a Muslim person in America, right? Like it's been a very painful period of time, right? And that book took a lot of pains to be inhabiting a good space.
Yeah. And I should point out, I'm not Muslim.
No.
But yeah, well, to put it a different way, the thing that struck me was that, you know, there's this ancient book from the Middle East that is supposed to be like at the heart and soul of what it means to be an American, and that's called the Bible. And there's this other ancient book from the Middle East. It's almost from the exact same place. It's like a half a day's drive from Jerusalem. And that book is just a total crazy book. And it, you know, how can this ancient book from the Middle East called the Bible become part of American life and this other book can't? And so the idea was to show that it quite easily can.
One of the other aspects of the book that strikes me so much, you know, we're talking about text and image, and we were talking about that in one kind of way with regard to the Dante project. You know, you worked on the translation together with your collaborator, but you didn't write out the translation, right, for Dante. That was printed, and then you had the illustrations that you created by hand. But for the American Quran project, like, the text is also all from your hand. Like, you've been the scribe as well as the illuminator. And I thought that was, like, I mean, I always find that the way I get to know a book really, really well is when I write out passages from it. I've never written out a whole book. Right? But I thought, what a weird and kind of transformative experience that must be. Like, it must become inside you in some kind of sense, that process of being the scribe.
It was very, it's very meditative. It's, you can't have the radio on or anything, because then you make a lot of typos. But yeah, you know, because, you know, I went and looked at historical Qurans from, you know, throughout history. And as you probably know, in Islamic art, calligraphy is so important. And so I knew it had to have some kind of calligraphy. And then like I always do, I go back to, how does that relate to today? And I thought, okay, well, who in my city really does calligraphy? And the first thing I thought of was graffiti writers. I mean, they write their name 100 different ways all day long. And so I wanted to come up with a font that resembled like early East LA graffiti or something, but that was simplified so it was still legible. As being like the American form of calligraphy would be graffiti.
There's something else I'm curious about, sort of formally speaking. It's as you say, you're taking this inspiration from earlier Quranic manuscripts, and it's totally obvious the way that the pages are laid out, the way that there's borders around both the page and the text within the page, and that the text is sort of in a particular spot on the page, and then there's an image sort of around the text, and that sometimes the image and the border can play with each other in interesting ways. But one of the things that I find really striking is how the images behind the text are often, you're often sort of obscuring what you might think of as the primary focus points of the image, if you see what I mean. It's not accidental or haphazard necessarily, but there's a very deliberate,
almost screening.
Yeah, playing with like what can you see and what can't you see past the text, and it's not quite as like all the human characters are standing very clearly in the illustrated sections or whatever. Like, now people get cut off. You can see just feet sometimes. You see a little bit of a car or something. It's really striking. And I'm wondering if what you were thinking. What were you thinking when you did that?
Well, it. Again, you know, I was really looking at a lot of historical Islamic artworks and in, you know, Indian Persian art painting, style of paintings and things. And it was a multi-year project, and I sort of grew as I worked on it. So at the very beginning, the earlier pages I did were, I was really trying to squeeze little people around the edges and things. And then I realized that there wasn't enough space to do that. And also that, if you did the scene like as if it was the whole page, your brain sort of just fills in the parts that you don't see. And I sort of learned that as I went, and then started to use it on purpose. Like you mentioned, there's a scene where there's only like the feet of three different people, like standing next to, I think in the gas chamber of a prison or something.
Yeah. 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 That one's very striking.
But you sense that, you know, that they're there. So it was a sort of a technique that I learned to do more as I went along.
It's like they're present. They may be not visible, but they're present. Mm-hmm. And you, as a viewer, like, you're very aware of their presence.
Yeah. So the idea of that project was that each page is an image that's a metaphor for that's some text on that page, and often it's quite obscure. But the more obvious ones are in the whole Surah, or the whole chapter that about the story of Noah's Ark. There's a scene of a guy building a canoe in his driveway, and then there's scenes of Hurricane Katrina hitting New Orleans. So they're contemporary metaphors for boat building and floods and such.
I remember the first time I read your American Quran, I remember those pages in particular really stood out to me, because it wasn't that long since Katrina, you know, and so it was still very much at the front of my mind. One of the, coming back to the visual, you know, one of the other things I really love about this book is a couple things. One of them, the way in which, you know, those very short surahs that appear toward the end of the Quran, you know, the Meccan surahs, the way they almost kind of float above the illustrations in this really striking, this graphically really striking way. And I don't know how to, to describe it, because it feels to me very faithful with medieval Quran manuscripts. Like, I work a lot on medieval manuscripts. That's one of the main things I do, right? And so it's very faithful, strikes me, to that, that feel of that kind of page, and that's that effect is highlighted by the way in which, you know, you do the borders and the pen work of the borders in a way that's very much in keeping with some of those medieval manuscripts. But I know, I look at it and I'm like, visually, I know that this is very different technique wise that, like, these, the text appears in this box formats that are very different. They're almost like reminiscent of certain kinds of film or video techniques, and yet the feel is like that of a manuscript page. And I just really curious to hear more about that, again, how that developed over time.
Yeah, well, when I decided to embark on this, one thing that really encouraged me to do it at the very beginning was I sort of accidentally visited the Chester Beatty Library in Dublin.
Oh, yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah, and
they have such a collection.
I think they claim that they have the second largest collection of Qurans in the world outside of Egypt, I think. So I was in Dublin just on holiday and went in there. While in my brain I was pondering doing this project, and I had so many doubts as whether it was even doable. And then I went in that and saw like 1,000 years of handmade Qurans all laid out in these cases. And then when you see them, I saw they were so amazing to see up close and not in reproduction. And that was the moment that I said, oh, I can do this too. Because, you know, you can see, when you see the originals, you see where they made mistakes and they fixed it and they crossed something out and they put white out on it. And then suddenly these things that I'd been looking at, you know, in reproductions that seem so intricately amazing and beautiful, you see that they're actually made by hand. And then that really encouraged me to have the confidence to do it myself.
Yeah, what a great experience. Mm-hmm. At the right moment too.
Yeah, it's another serendipity moment.
Yeah.
So that project finished up 5-6 years ago, I suppose. What have you been working on since then, and where next? Are there any other books that are tempting you to adapt them?
I've thought about it a lot. The press I worked with, Trillium Press in San Francisco, keeps saying we should do another project, and I haven't found the right one yet. I did about 2 years ago, I guess. You forget the COVID years, just before COVID. So like 3 years ago, I did a project with a place in San Francisco called Aryan Press, which is this fantastic bookmaking place. It's this big, giant building where they make books all by letterpress and hand, and they do it in the old traditional way and everything, and using all the old machines. And they asked if I would do a book with them, but they had a really short deadline, and all the ones I sort of pitched, they didn't want to do, or they had already done. And we ended up doing Oscar Wilde's Fairy Tales.
Interesting.
Which was a short, I think there's only like 11 or 14 little short stories. But I was on my way to Ireland for an art residency. And it was great because I was in Ireland doing the drawings about Ireland that, you know, that Oscar Wilde's from. And that came out. So they did a small run of those. And that was the last real book I did. But I was pitching on, you know, like I've mentioned, I grew up surfing, and I surf all the time. And it's been a sort of a thread through my whole life. It's about where I live and it takes me where I travel. And so I've always drawn to ocean things. And, you know, I was pitching them on Moby Dick and all that.
Oh, definitely.
And Treasure Island was a book that really influenced me when I was a kid. But they had already done Moby Dick. They've done this amazing Moby Dick.
There's no such thing as too many letterpress art versions of Moby Dick. I just want to say that for the record.
Yeah, you should look up Aryan Press. It's A-R-I-O-N.
I will.
Yeah, it's an amazing book place. They're one of those places that's like a cultural heritage thing that's just not making money. It just goes along through support.
No, that's super important.
If you had sort of infinite time, money, and, you know, et cetera. Is there anything that would particularly excite you to do?
Or is it a question of just stumbling on the right thing in the right moment?
I think the right moment has to come along. I did another project after the Quran. I did a series of prints with a place in New Zealand, in Auckland, a place called the Auckland Print Studio. I went to Auckland for 2 months and worked with them, and we did a series of prints that were also based on Doré's illustrations for Pantagruel. Gargantua and Pantagruel.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I read bits and pieces of that book. I took a lot of those images and I twisted them around, and they were all about President Trump when he was in office.
Oh, wow.
And we did a series called Trumpagruel. And, and they're all quite funny, and they look very much like Doré's images as well.
Oh, wow.
But if I was to do another book, it'd be, I spent a lot of time in Latin America. I lived in Brazil for 4 years, so I would definitely go for a Latin American book.
Ah, are there any books from that part of the world that you'd be drawn to? Books in Portuguese, or do you feel yourself drawn, or is it a question of just being open to the possibility?
Open. I mean, I read, when I lived in Brazil, I read all the classic Brazilian ones, the posthumous memories of Brás Cubas, where it's, I think the whole story is told through the eyes of the dog. It's really kind of charming. It's almost like Tristram Shandy. But more recently, I read 6666 by, is it Bolsonaro?
What is it, 2066 or 2666?
Yeah, that 66? One. It's a series of three books, all set in Mexico.
Yeah, by Roberto Bolaño. Yeah.
Yeah, those are amazing. I would love to do those because I'm familiar with Mexico.
Well, yeah, the local is always very present in your work. I mean, you were talking a little bit about the way in which when you were choosing the font for American Quran, it wasn't just graffiti you were thinking about, but specifically LA type graffiti. And I get that sense that the local is a really important kind of driving force in your work.
It's been a theme. When I went to art school in the 80s, and at that time, I mean, I came out of, I studied painting at Otis Parsons here in LA, and for the handful of us that came out of school all at the same time, there was the discussion of, you know, we want to be real artists. And then, like, most of them, my friends, moved straight away to New York, you know, because in the 80s, that's where you had to go.
But you wanted to surf.
Yeah. I was never moving to New York. Forget that. I'm sticking at Malibu. So I stayed in LA. And from the very outset, I was like, you know, I hate hearing that New York is the most important art place. I want to make my city the most important art city. So I intentionally did projects where every picture is, this is LA, this is the LAPD, this is the LA riots, this is the, you know, the horrible things happening here or the good things happening here. And it's been a thread throughout.
Which is, you know, a very Dante approach to things.
Yeah, it's my
it's your Florence.
It's your Florence.
Love it and hate it. I'm not exiled yet.
Thank you so much for spending time in conversation with us. This has been really great. I hope we get another chance in the future.
No, it's really nice. You know, I spend so much time working alone. It's nice to know that people are out there looking at the books and reading the books I've worked on. So it's really rewarding. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And listeners, if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us at spouter@megaphonic.fm, or we're on Twitter @TheSpouter. We'd love to hear from you. Show notes with links to Sandow's website and everything else that we've mentioned in this episode are at megaphonic.fm/spouter/55b. And The Spouter Inn is one of the fancy little podcasts over at Megaphonic FM. So until next time.
Until next time. See you again at The Spouter Inn.